morning. May it please the court. My name is Bert Ryan, and I am appearing here on behalf of the relator, Dr. John Oberg. And this appeal focuses on the single question, the application of the term person or any person in the False Claims Act to the four defendant corporations who were created by their state owners to engage in a for-profit, nationwide, self-sustaining business of financing and servicing federally reinsured and subsidized student loans. It's the business venture which gave rise to the case. Each defendant has a legal personality, and in fact, it is in the terms that the Congress was familiar with.
That's a very curious term, legal personality. And did you make it up?
Well, I think the term that was familiar to the Congress was a body politic and corporate.
Indeed.
And that seemed to mean something with a legal personality independent of the state. And Congress used that term, and the Supreme Court recognized that that term swept quite broadly. It was anything that had a
corporate. The Supreme Court doesn't talk about legal personality.
No, it talks about bodies corporate and politic and corporate, which is exactly the term that's used in the statutes that created these defendants. They're deemed to be bodies politic and corporate. So it's a parallelism of term. It is the precise term the Supreme Court focused on. These defendants were entitled to raise hundreds of millions, in some cases billions of dollars in loan funds for which the states took no financial responsibility. Expressly in their enabling statutes, the states disavow any financial responsibility for the bonds and notes that are the backbone of the business. The defendants hold property in their own names. They can sue and be sued in their own names, and they're sued in their own names here. They have broad business authority under their enabling statutes to make, acquire, and service loans, and they're free to participate in the national loan markets. They can seek money nationally. They can acquire bundles of loans all over the country. They can service loans anywhere they want to, and this is to enable them to make profit because they're set up to be profit-making institutions.
Well, it's not your position, is it, that any profit-making corporation is not a state agency?
Well, our position comes directly.
Well, is that your position? You can tell me what it is. That
well,
your position?
I don't know if that's the full limit of our position. That is to say whether.
That is an argument you're making.
Yes, that is
no
an argument.
No profit-making, well, may I ask you this? Is it your position that no corporation can be a state agency?
I think that we would say that the presumption created under Chandler is that if it's a corporation, it is presumed to be a person within the meaning of the False Claims Act.
Right.
Now, if there's something in the subsequent enactments, as analyzed in Chandler, that says, no, this is a special entity, and it is not subject to the presumption of personhood, that is, you can overcome it, then it's overcome. But I don't think we have to answer every possible case today. What we have are the kinds of entities which seem to fit squarely within the Chandler analysis. I understand they're not municipal corporations as such, but the way the Supreme Court analyzed the meaning of the term person, it was protective of the federal fisc. And the court said the purpose of the False Claims Act is to protect the federal government as broadly as possible. It said that expressly in Chandler, and it was reflecting earlier jurisprudence. So the presumption was that if there was a personality, a person, and I know you don't like that term, but if there's
I like it only because it doesn't mean anything outside this case.
Well, a body politic and corporate, which does mean something in this case because that's what we have before us, so that it could stand and be sued in its own name, you presume it to be a person, and the burden shifts to that body politic and corporate to demonstrate why Congress would have excluded it and given it an immunity from being accountable in false claims. I think that, of course, is the central issue.
Well, how are we to analyze these entities?
Well, I think you've got to start from the teaching of the Supreme Court because that's really where it begins.
Do you have a test?
I don't think the court set forth an express test. It set forth
set forth an express test in some other area of the law that we should import here.
Well, some circuits have resorted to 11th Amendment analysis and said, well, you know, if something's an arm of the state, perhaps it ought to be called a state agency. I'm not sure that the 11th Circuit is the perfect model, the 11th Amendment, because in an 11th Amendment case, you're looking at the ability of a private individual to bring into court a sovereign. And the question is, are the kinds of persons that are being brought into court so related to the sovereign that you impair the sovereignty of the state? You insult its dignity, as the courts have said.
What about the arm of the state analysis? Do you find flawed here, the four-part test that the cases have set forth, cases such as Hoover? What do you find flawed about that with application to this situation?
Well, I think, you know, it's not that we find it is a flawed test, because we believe these entities would meet.
So are you agreeing that an arm of the state analysis does apply?
Well, I think we have not gone all that way. We believe if you applied it, you'd have to come to the conclusion, even using that analysis, and there are three cases that do so.
Right, but I'm asking you about the proper analysis to employ, and why would you not use arm of the state?
I think that because I think in fair reading of Stevens and Chandler together, is that when the court was talking about a state agency, and that was the word that was used in Stevens, it was a state, in parentheses, a state agency, it's really talking about an organic part of the state's governance apparatus. That is to say, the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources, which was the subject of the suit in the Stevens case, was essentially a cabinet department of the Vermont government. And the case was all discussed in terms of the state of Vermont. And it wasn't until the very end, and perhaps recognizing that the named defendant was not Vermont by name, but the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources, that the court parenthetically said, and state agencies. But that context...
I think if the Vermont Department of Natural Resources had been incorporated, as it is in some states, the result would have been different there?
No, I don't think the result would have been different there, because again, you're talking about a governmental operation where the state is operating in its typical sovereign capacity. Here we're talking about a business operation. And if you look at the case law, whether they call it 11th Amendment analysis, or they talk more generally, you look at the Massachusetts Housing Finance Corporation case decided by Chief Judge Lamberth in the DC Circuit, you look at Sekenga, you look at Rouse, all of those cases are looking at business entities and saying, whoops, something's wrong here. Whatever the formalism Congress meant by the broad terms it used in 863, and its understanding that the term person then included all bodies politic and corporate, to say, we start with the presumption that you're bound by the act. You're accountable when you defraud the federal government. What do you show us?
Do you read the Supreme Court as saying the same thing?
I think that's exact. I think what the court has set up is a framework with a presumption which looks to federal law as the source of overcoming the presumption. Because if you examine both Supreme Court cases, there's no resort to state law as such. What they do is say...
Now you're slipping into what formula or what bone of analysis we have, which I thought you would be embracing the one that we put before you, but you don't want to embrace that.
Well, right? I think we
so
want...
You don't want to embrace looking at individual portions of state law, and you don't want to embrace the normal 11th Amendment. So what else is there?
Well,
because you incorporate, that's all.
No, I don't think we're saying that, Your Honor. I think
okay.
What we're saying is we're looking at the function that is performed by the entity. If it isn't a corporation, if the state has not given it the right to sue and be sued, if it can't stand as a body politic and corporate, it has an argument that it's not swept within the 1863 usage. When it doesn't have that available because it's swept within the 1863 usage, then you have to start examining what function of the state governance is played by the company. Now, you do have to look at how it's set up. What are its terms? Where does it stand under state law? Because that's the only way you can tell what's it doing. And you also look, in fact, at its operation. So I think what we're saying is we think the best reading is to start from the presumption that this court set up in Chandler. First ask the question, is there anything about this class of entity, and I'm trying to use a neutral word, which would have persuaded Congress that they should be beyond the reach of the False Claims Act? If that does not appear in federal law, then start examining what they do, what their powers are, how they're entitled to conduct their affairs, and see whether they can bring themselves within the framework that was set up in Stevens. Are they administering the governance of the state? And that can't just be enough in itself, and the reason I say that is Cook County was established by the state of Illinois. And the Supreme Court, 9-0, still said, you're accountable under the False Claims Act. It was performing governmental functions. But the court said, you know, it's a municipal corporation. That's a body politic and incorporate. So we have to presume, as set up in Stevens, that it is swept into this act. And we see nothing in the subsequent enactments that said Congress wanted to take it out. So they're using a very protective principle, protective of the federal fisc, which is, look, unless you can get out by saying Congress didn't reach you with the words it chose, given their meaning in 1863, it's an uphill fight to fight your way out of accountability. And it makes all the sense in the world, because remember, while this is a relator case, the term person also affects the rights of the federal government. There's no limitation on the federal government suing a state. If you're not a person, you can't be reached by the federal government. You're just not subject to the act. So the framework of individuals bringing a state before a federal court is not the prime framework of the False Claims Act. The prime framework of the False Claims Act is actions by the federal government to protect itself against fraud. So it's a very different kind of balance. And that's why we're saying, while 11th Amendment analysis can be useful, it'll tell you things about the nature of the entity before you. It's not determinative, because entities that are engaged in business functions operating all over the country have been before courts three times, and notwithstanding, and they've looked at in an 11th Amendment framework, they always, all three cases, say they're businesses. And they're accountable to the federal treasury. They can't defraud the federal government. That's really the core issue in this case. Do you have immunity? The states here chose to set up enterprises with corporate form, so their bodies politic and corporate. They had to know that was going to bring them within the reach of the word person as Congress defined it in 1863. Because there are earlier cases prior to the False Claims Act, which the courts had held that a person, a corporation created by a state, is not the state. And state ownership alone does not exempt you from the power of Congress. And so when the Congress used a term that it did understand, according to the Supreme Court, swept to all bodies politic and corporate, it's laid down a principle. And the question is, are there exceptions to it? And certainly Stevens says, well, if you're suing the state in its core operations by naming one of its departments, so technically you're not suing the state, that's not good enough. You've got to sue something that is independent and separate. But that was the whole purpose of setting these entities up, to keep them separate, to keep the bondholders away from the state treasury, to allow them to compete with private banking companies in the banking business of acquiring loans, issuing notes, and funding, to allow them to make profit, and also to avoid certain tax limitations that require them to be separated as corporations. That's one of the reasons they were put into this form. But this is a choice by the state. They chose to create these independent business entities. And now they're saying, well, they're immune. They're not accountable for the frauds they commit. The complaint, which has to be taken as true, alleges almost $220 million in fraud. This is a pretty serious matter. And the case started with both private, that is to say, non-state related, because they've been privatized, entities doing the same thing. They're all on a level playing field in terms of the business they do, the scope of the business. So I think what we're saying is they can't fit within the state agency concept, as that concept was established in Stevens, and they do fit within the framework that was established in Chandler. The presumption applies, and the fact that they are related to the state owns them. Clearly, by 1863, that was not a determinative consideration, because you had the railroad cases and the bank cases saying state ownership is insufficient to turn a company into a state. So ownership doesn't do it. Now, as owner, the state is going to have power over these companies, because any owner can select a board of directors. Any owner can take a dividend. All the things that the defendants have brought out as, well, the state can do this and that, are really aspects of ownership. But when you make the decision as a state to separate and create a corporation, a body politic and corporate, and name it as such, you're talking exactly in the terms that the Supreme Court used in those cases. So I think our framework is protective of the federal government. It's to take the presumptions as they lie in the two Supreme Court cases and to look at the entities as established under state law, to see whether they're performing functions in the way comparable to the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources. And I think that's not arguable here. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan. Mr. Hewitt.
Sir, if there was a judgment against your client in this kind of suit, who would pay it?
The judgment would be paid out of the state's treasury. All the revenue of the Pennsylvania Higher Education Assistance Agency, my client, all their revenue is deposited into the state treasury. And so any judgment that would be rendered against FIA, which is the acronym that we use, would be paid from the state treasury.
There are no bonds that you issue?
No, it is correct that FIA issues bonds, but issues bonds only with the permission of the governor. And with respect to that, it's exercising the public function that the state has chosen to confer on FIA. What I think is important to remember here.
So, can I just continue my question?
Of course.
For a moment? So, the proceeds from the bond sale go into the state treasury directly and do not go to you directly?
The proceeds from the bond issues go into the state treasury and are used to finance the public education of Pennsylvania residents.
Are any of those proceeds used for any other purpose?
No
state administration. You know, if you're part of a state agency or a state government, it's like having a big landlord. It's often any piece of money that you raise, part of it goes to the boss that's running the whole show. But that's not what happened here.
Well, what happened here, Your Honor, is that with regard to FIA revenue, it goes two places. Well, it goes in the state treasury. But with regard to what it is used for, and this is with permission of the state treasurer, because the state treasurer has to approve all disbursements out of the state treasury. And the Auditor General, of course, audits every year every penny that FIA spends. But it goes to pay for FIA's overhead, which I think in Your Honor's analogy would be to pay the boss, because the boss then no longer has to pay that overhead. And it goes to finance the educations of Pennsylvania state residents.
So this money is going back and forth all the time?
No, it goes one place. It goes into the state treasury.
Uh-huh.
And from the state treasury, just like our own bank accounts, if money that we earn is placed into a bank account, we write checks on that. It's no different than here. All the money from FIA, all the revenue, gets deposited in the state treasury.
So if there was a recovery in an action like this against you, and it was more than in your bank account with the state, what would happen?
What would happen there is that the state would have to do something with regard to that judgment. And let me answer that question a little more precisely.
How do we know what the state would have to do?
Well, understand that by state statute, if the state dissolves FIA, all that revenue reverts to the state. So by analogy then, if there's a judgment that cannot be satisfied solely out of the revenues of FIA, that seems to me the state's going to dissolve FIA and it will have to be responsible for a judgment.
But there's no state law that says that.
There's no state law that says that. And we're talking about a practical effect. And I think that practical effect is something that the court talked about in Hoover and Maryland Stadium Authority, where it said that if the impact on the state treasury violates the state's autonomy, then in that sense, it satisfies the state treasury factor under the four-factor test.
I understand that, but I'm still not clear, and I don't think it's your fault, but I'm not sure that it's clear as a matter of state law exactly what would happen if the judgment exhausted your account, if you will, with the state.
You know, I think that's...
I don't know that we know that the state, under state law, would have to step up to the plate.
I think that's correct, Your Honor, but let me, since Your Honor seems to be focusing on the state treasury factor,
Well, it is supposedly the most important factor. I didn't pick it out of the blue.
And exactly, and that's the point I want to address. It is not the most important.
Okay.
That's what Oberg argues, but it's not the most important. And let me tell you why. Under the Supreme Court's decision in South Carolina Ports Authority versus Federal Maritime Commission, it held that, in essence, this Treasury factor is no longer paramount. And we know that to be true because the Third Circuit in the Bend decision said that in light of that Supreme Court's decision, all four factors for the Armistead analysis must now be weighed equally. But even more importantly, there are two district court decisions from the District of South Carolina, and one of them, the Smith decision, Judge Floyd, specifically says that. And let me read to you what the judge said in that particular case, because I think that it's very important to understand that. So in the Smith decision, which talked about this Treasury factor, whether it is now the most important one or not, in light of the Supreme Court's decision in South Carolina State Ports Authority, the judge said, thus, in light of Federal Maritime, it would appear that the Treasury prong, as explained in Cash, has been significantly modified so as to greatly diminish its importance in any state sovereign immunity analysis.
I guess I read the case as saying it didn't have as determinative force as it once had, but it still is an important factor.
Well, that that's
but
my
maybe I'm misreading the cases.
Well, and I think that's my second point, Your Honor, that even though some court were to find that any one of these appellees did not meet the state Treasury factor, as recently as the court's decision this January in Lee Thomas, the court said that the court can still find that if the other three factors are satisfied, that that entity qualifies as a state agency under the arm of the state analysis.
But we're here on 12b-6. How do we know what has been established?
Well, we know that we have filed a motion to dismiss under 12b-6. We know that Dr. Oberg never objected to that, never said that this is so highly factual intensive that the court cannot decide on a motion to dismiss.
You met your burden.
Well, I don't think burden is the question of 12b-6, Your Honor. I think the question of 12.
You are proposing a defense, are you not?
Correct.
All right. Why don't you have the burden to show that you're a state agency? It's not their job to establish that.
Well, and I agree with that analysis. I agree that with regard to a 12b-6 motion, it is our burden to show that the plaintiff has not properly pleaded a cause of action under the law. And what we say, and what I think the district court obviously agreed with, is that for purposes of Dr. Oberg's case, that none of the appellees qualify as persons under the False Claim Act. And in I think that it's important to understand here, Your Honor, that the court need look no further than the Stevens decision to utterly reject Dr. Oberg's holding. First of all, the Stevens decision begins in its very first paragraph by saying that this applies to states and state agencies. There's no question that from the very beginning of that opinion that the court was focused laser-like on state agencies. And the rationale for Stevens is vitally important to rejecting Dr. Oberg's position. The rationale of Stevens was that the court did not want to upset the constitutional balance between state and state agencies as sovereigns in the federal system, and held that to be paramount, if you will, with regard to finding that none of the appellees are persons under the False Claims Act. And here, contrary to Dr. Oberg's formulation, the states exercise their sovereign powers to deliver a very important state function by forming the appellees to deliver that state service. So that's how the state and state agencies have exercised their sovereignty. And Stevens teaches us that that has to be uppermost in anyone's mind with regard to deciding whether a state agency qualifies as a person. Chandler has nothing to do with this case, Your Honor.
I take it that this state agency is not represented by the Attorney General's office of the state. Is that correct?
That it is.
I don't see the Attorney General's office.
Let me answer that, Your Honor.
I had
never introduced myself, so let me introduce myself. My name is Dan Hewitt, and I represent the Pennsylvania Higher Education Assistance Agency. I am here at the direct delegation of the Pennsylvania State Attorney General.
I bet you're not an Assistant Attorney General.
I am not, but Your Honor, one of the state statutes with regard to FEA says that when FEA is sued or be sued, they must go to the Pennsylvania State Attorney General to get permission to defend itself or to pursue a claim. Therefore, the Pennsylvania Attorney General must consent to that. In this case, they consented to my representation by directly delegating their authority to me to represent its agency in this particular case. So
you represent the agency in other matters in which you don't have a direct delegation from the Attorney General?
No. Every single matter in which FIA uses outside counsel, if you will, comes from the direct delegation by the Pennsylvania State Attorney General.
So it wasn't just this case. There's some general delegation, is what you're saying.
It's very general and very specific and done in every single case, Your Honor.
Very general and very specific.
Okay. Yes, I know. I know. I should say in all cases, to be more specific about it, Your Honor. But let me sum by saying as follows. Chandler decision really has no application here. In its very first paragraph and very last paragraph, it makes it clear that its holding is limited to local governments. We know that local governments do not enjoy the same sovereignty status as states and state agencies do, as designated by the Stevens case. So the Chandler case really has nothing to do with this case. The second reason is that the Stevens decision specifically rejected Chandler. Now, that may seem odd since Chandler came after Stevens, but it specifically rejected it by saying that the presumption that Dr. Oberg relies on, the presumption that person includes corporations, does not apply to the states and state agencies. So it actually anticipated Chandler and said that that corporate presumption, personhood, if you will, that Dr. Oberg relies on, absolutely does not apply here. And the third reason why Stevens is paramount here and Chandler cannot be relied on is there are two circuit court decisions, one in the Fifth Circuit and one in the Tenth Circuit, that when analyzing the issue of whether a state agency is a person for purposes of the False Claims Act, says that in each instance, each of those held that the Chandler test was rejected. And I see that my time has expired here, Your Honor.
So we'll let Mr. Appler pick up where you left off.
May it please the Court, Thomas Appler for Kentucky Higher Education Student Loan Corporation, referred to by most acronyms as KESLIC.
If there was a recovery against your client in a case like this, who would pay the judgment?
That would depend upon when and how much and by whom.
All right.
Obviously, first.
I'm up for grabs. Tell me about all that.
First, the first inquiry, I would think, would be if there were funds against which that recovery were, there were funds allocated specifically, like a bond. But we're not, if you're asking if we are a person,
about a suit exactly
FCA,
like this one.
well, of course, it would depend on the amount. If there were funds in the account of this state agency that were there, they presumably would be used for that purpose. If
is
there were not.
In state law that tells you, like, you know, often, when you represent a state and you are in court and there is a claim against you, you're looking around to see where the recovery would come from. But this matter hasn't occurred to you before?
Oh, it's occurred to me. It's occurred
well,
to me to
the,
think
where's
that
it's going to come from if they get a big judgment against you.
The probability comes from the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Because well, in 2005, the Commonwealth took.
Does Kentucky law tell us that?
Kentucky doesn't have a statute that says what happens to these funds when they're put in the hands of the Kentucky Treasury, as they were in the biennium that the Kentucky had in 2004 through 2006, when some $70 million were appropriated by the Kentucky General Assembly from the funds of KESLIC for state purposes. I think the first place to answer that question would be to go to look at one who was tracing those funds and would go to Kentucky and say, you took the $60 million, $70 million that was developed by these acts, and therefore you have to pay it back.
The bond was, money.
Excuse me?
Talking about the 60 the, or 70.
This, the Commonwealth of Kentucky, yes, that's quite right, Your Honor.
The bond money by your client or by the Commonwealth of Kentucky? What?
The funds
you
that
have
were.
You have to sort of spoon feed this to me, so I'm not following you. Where did that money
the funds
come from?
That, were, that came from the operations, fiscal operations, bonding, what
but
amounts.
If I start out on the street of Richmond having an operation, I don't have any $60 million coming to me.
No, you don't. Well, so this entity.
How did this happen?
This issued, as the state authorized it to, issued bonds to cover.
Okay, so it was bond money.
It's bond raised. Money. It's operations money, which is contributed
okay,
and doled out to the state.
The bondholders that bought those bonds, if the bonds had gone up, would they be able to look to the Commonwealth of Kentucky to make them good?
bondholders? I believe the answer in the state law would be no, because there's a specific statute under bondholders.
Okay.
But operations, fiscal operations, the funds that were earned, if you will, by Keswick were and are appropriated and contributed to the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Now,
They all come back to you? Do they come back to your client? I understand they go to the Commonwealth of Kentucky.
No. They go to the Commonwealth of Kentucky just like they did in 2000.
Well, you need some money to operate your operation, right?
That's right.
Okay. So some money comes to you from somewhere to do that.
The operations of the entity and funding educational loans produce that money to fund them, and the Commonwealth, of course,
that
has the help.
That money first go to the Commonwealth and then back to you?
No.
Or does that go directly to you?
It goes directly to Keswick as a result of its operations. It is then appropriated by Kentucky, who controls all those funds, and then goes. Now, if you asked about a judgment, we only have 3 minutes, each of us, but the real answer would be there's no state statute that's applicable.
Well, is it a duty under Kentucky statute section 164A.0104? Because doesn't that statute provide that the actions and duties of your client are to be carried out to the end that the assets of the Commonwealth be not committed to such purpose? So
that's true.
Tell
and that
me
is
whether that applies to judgments.
That is with respect to the bonding operations. And I think that while that is true, that's the touchstone of the Commonwealth's decision to control its fiscal matters.
So you're saying a judgment against your client would not be a duty?
It wouldn't be. That is with respect to the bond funds. That's correct.
Okay.
Of course, their operations are to conserve. Now, I apologize. You weren't told, but the initial arguer got 11 minutes. We each got 3.
We were told. But
okay.
This is, you take your life in your hands when you speak.
I understand that. And may I say one other thing, since you have written on this subject, Judge Motz?
The Chief Judge.
Financial treasury factor, I think, has been answered. Thank you.
Mr. West.
Maybe, Mr. West, you can just start out telling me.
Your Honor,
save time.
I knew exactly where I was going to start. So on behalf of the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation, the Vermont state law does not specifically indicate how a judgment against VSAC would apply to the state. However, the state code does provide that the state must support and maintain VSAC. And to that end, the Vermont state legislature provides annual appropriations to VSAC, a percentage of which must be used for operation and administrative expenses. So we submit to you that indeed a judgment against VSAC, even if paid by VSAC, would have a direct impact on the state treasury, because those state appropriated funds would be subject to that judgment. And the net revenues of VSAC by statute are, in fact, they inure only to the benefit of the state. And if VSAC were to terminate, all of its property vests in the state. So a judgment rendered against VSAC, if paid only by VSAC, would attach to those revenues.
Paid only by VSAC.
If it were a judgment only against the entity itself and not against the state. The state law is silent. In fact, VSAC has never been sued. So until this case. So we don't have any case law to look at. But those appropriated revenues would be subject to that payment, as well as the assets of VSAC, which to the extent that they exist ultimately belong to the state. And so that's how we would address that question. Now, Mr. Oberg has argued that VSAC is not a part of the sovereign because it is not a traditional agency like the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources or the Department of Education, too, that he points out. And we agree that our structure and our functions are different from the Agency of Natural Resources. And it's a cabinet-level agency. But in fact, VSAC was formed and established.
VSAC is a cabinet-level agency?
It is not. I'm saying the Agency of Natural Resources is. Okay. VSAC was, in fact, established 4 years before Vermont legislature chose to create certain cabinet-level agencies. Now, with respect
to
the...
That would prevent it from making VSAC a cabinet-level agency.
No, it doesn't. But in fact, the Department of Education, which Mr. Oberg cites to, is not a cabinet-level agency. And like VSAC, it is governed by a board, and it is, and not by someone directly appointed, the governor. So we think that these differences do not make VSAC any less of a state agency. They merely demonstrate that the Vermont legislature has chosen different forms through which to govern its state government. Now, the other factor of the arm of the state that I wanted to touch on briefly is just that they do not have unfettered discretion. And when you look at the control that the state has, we believe that they are an agency of the state. And I see my time is up. Thank you.
Hear from Mr. Connolly.
Tom Connolly on behalf of ASLA. With me is Assistant Attorney General Mark Orenberger from the state of Arkansas. Maryland Stadium Authority indicates as long as the judgment would reach funds subject to state control, state audit, state budget, and planning.
Recovery in this case.
Well, that's what I'm addressing, Your Honor. That's what matters. It's not whether Oberg can go after all the state's money. It's whether it can go after any. That's what...
What money can it go after here?
Oberg can put his claim. The money that's directly available under ASLA's control are cash funds. That's a term of art under the Arkansas Code for state funds held outside of the state treasury by a state agency. If those cash funds are subject to appropriation and reaching those cash funds, again, it doesn't matter under Hoover. The inquiry does not focus on whether the funds are retained in a particular account of the state or the general fund of the state treasury.
Can they go against the cash funds that are appropriated to the Department of Human Resources? They can only go against the cash funds that are...
Certainly they can go after the state funds that are under ASLA's control and subject to appropriation by the state. That's clear. And I think that's enough to meet the Treasury prong. What happens if those state funds are exhausted and a judgment takes place? That's a complicated and an unresolved question. You can't enforce a federal judgment against the state of Arkansas or ASLA under state and state law collection procedures. So it's a matter of comity to begin with. I mean, it's really an artificial question. If there's a federal judgment against the state of Arkansas, that's going to go to the State Claims Commission and be resolved as a matter of comity under normal procedures. But it's not as if the federal government could...
I actually don't think that's right. I think there are huge areas of the law where the federal government can come in and get a judgment against the state.
I'm not suggesting they can't get a judgment.
Well,
I'm just saying I don't...
You told me that you couldn't get a judgment that would be payable to the federal government as well, not just a judgment.
No,
you're not making the argument that...
I'm not arguing that the federal government can't get a judgment against the state. I'm just saying as a matter of, you know, the question here is not a question of... Oberg's argument is an argument of form over substance. A judgment against ASLA would reach state funds that are subject to state appropriation, and that satisfies the first prong of the arm of the state inquiry. Whether and how a federal judgment against ASLA would be enforced if all the ASLA state funds were exhausted is a very complicated question. And I'm not saying that the federal government can't get a judgment against Arkansas. I'm saying the enforcement of that judgment is very complicated. In addition, I would like to also address with my time remaining, I'd like to point the court to the joint appendix at 161 to 164, the appropriations bill. You look at that appropriations bill, the specific appropriations, the restrictions on use of funds, the requirement that the Attorney General authorize and consent to the hiring of any counsel, the host of state statutes regarding expenditures and conduct of state agencies that ASLA has to comply with. You can't look at that appropriations bill and come to the conclusion that ASLA is anything other than what the Arkansas Code, the Arkansas Supreme Court, the Arkansas Attorney General, the District Court, and the arm of the state test all say it is, a state agency.
Thank you, Congressman. Mr. Ryan.
Your Honor, out of the questioning, a couple of points have come up that I think need to be cemented for clarification. One is that this is a 12B6 motion. The defendants said that they could persuade the court based on their state statutes that they were not persons within the meaning of the False Claims Act. So that is their burden. And you've heard them stumbling around as to where the money would come from because the statutes don't say it. They've come up here and said the statutes don't say it. They speculate on what might happen. But also, all of the statutes say that the property is property of the entity. On dissolution, the owner will get it. But what that means is, less than until they dissolve, this is property of the company, and that's the funds you can reach.
It's troubling to me, and I would look to you for a little guidance here. We have this up on a 12B6 motion.
Correct.
Both sides moved for judgment on the 12B6 motion.
No, we opposed it.
I thought you moved for 12B6.
No, we opposed the motion.
So all you're here about is they shouldn't have been granted the motion.
Right. I think we're here, but we believe that the law, when you read the statutes, which they did put
you're
before the court.
You're prepared to take any additional relief we would get you. But all you're doing here is
well, I think
to get them their 12B6 motion in their behalf.
They brought the motion. We opposed the motion. And therefore, our burden was to show that they could not foreclose the possibility. That's the burden in 12B6. So I think with respect to where the money comes from, the statutes are clear. They have money in their own names. And FIA comes up and says, well, it's in the state treasury. That account, by statute, is subject to the exclusive control of FIA. They're just playing the bank in the state treasury. That's true of all of them. Then there's a theoretical control in that they say, well, ultimately, the state being the owner is entitled to the proceeds. And Kentucky says, well, we took a big dividend out of the profits. Well, so, you know, that happens in all corporate situations. It doesn't mean that you're on the hook. And the 11th Amendment really protects state treasuries against bankruptcy because that was the thrust of it at the time of the Revolutionary War, to protect states from being crippled by federal lawsuits. So I think on that factor, they really haven't established anything. I think there was one other point which really they muddied up, and I think it's worth explaining. You said, where does the money come from? Where does the money go? Under these statutes, all of them have the power to create and fund trusts. They can't get these bonds sold because the state's full faith and credit is not behind them unless they assure the bondholders they're going to get paid. And so the way the business operates is they create a trust, they put the loans in the trust. All of the income and principal payment, interest in principal on the loans is put into the trust. They have administrative fees they take out of the trust. They have the residual interest in the trust. But this is what they call the SLABS business, student loan asset-backed securities. That's how it works. And they're just creating an illusion here. They don't throw the money in the treasury. That money coming from the repayment goes right into the trust, and it is released in accordance with the terms of the trust. And I think that it's not, you know, it's not proper to say it. And every statute before you talks about the trust because that's how the business is going to operate. They have the power to create them. They have the power to fund them. So when they take money out, that money is in the nature of profit. Now, the defendants try to disparage the Chandler. They say, well, Chandler was overruled by Stevens, even though Stevens came before Chandler. Somewhat a remarkable proposition. And in fact, Stevens said expressly, corporations are different. The presumption works in the other direction. And Chandler quotes Stevens to the effect that we're now in a situation where we have a person who is body politic and corporate. And we said in Stevens, the presumption would reverse. And let's see whether there's something that would overcome the presumption. So those cases do come together, but they don't come together in the way the defendant suggests. And that laser-like focus in the first sentence is a parenthetical, recognizing that the entity before the court was the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources. So I don't think you can call that a laser-like function.
The entity we have in front of us now is not like the entity in either one of those Supreme Court cases. And that I think, is sort of the fundamental problem the parties have here.
Well,
they want to read those cases as black, and you want to read them as white, and they're neither.
Well, it's certainly not the same entity as Stevens, and it is not a municipal corporation, strictly speaking, but it is a body politic.
It's not a municipal corporation in any sense of the word.
Correct. But I think it's in fact a weaker case than a municipal corporation, because a municipal corporation is exercising governmental functions. Cook County was created by the Illinois legislature. And if anything was going to be backed up by the state's funding, it was Cook County. The state had responsibility for that administration. The county was part of the administrative apparatus. That's what they argued. And the Supreme Court said, no, not good enough to overcome the protection that Congress afforded to the U.S. Treasury.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ryan.
Thank you.
I will come down and greet counsel and then go into the next case.